Okay, I'm going to start because we have so many panelists and so many things to talk about. I'm Ann Gunkel. Dr. Booth has asked me to moderate the panel, which just means that I'm the fascist who yells at people when they talk too long. So welcome to Doctor Who and Philosophy. So we're just going to go in the order that you have in your program of our various speakers. And so first, I'm very pleased to introduce Jerry Canavan, who teaches literature in the English department at Marquette University. That's where I got my BA. Yay, Marquette. He primarily writes about the relationship between science fiction genre and contemporary global politics. Please welcome Dr. Canavan.
So I will be talking from a kind of academic perspective. I'm a chronic overthinker. After the first presentation, this makes me feel a little bit like a snake in the garden. And so if you have to blame somebody, you can blame Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat, because I'm a new convert to the series and mostly am familiar with their take on the Doctor, which is obviously much darker than some of the earlier stuff. I mostly write about science fiction, some science fiction studies perspective. Science fiction studies gets its start in the 1970s when people are trying to promote it as a kind of worthy version of literature. And their answer to why it is worthy is that it's ultimately about utopia. It's about our unhappiness under the current system and our desire for some kind of better world, right? And so all science fiction can kind of be transformed into this kind of rumination on utopia, what's gone wrong and how we might fix it. And that lasts for about 30 years until there's an imperial turn in science fiction studies in the 2000s, where people say, well, what are we leaving out when we talk about utopia? We're talking about military science fiction. We're talking about race fantasy, right? Genocidal fantasy, right? There's actually all these kind of dark themes in science fiction that turns it from a genre kind of the left more into a genre of the right, a genre that's concerned about the needs of the state and its kind of independence from other forces. And so my interest in science in Doctor Who is I see it as really kind of interrogating this tension and embodying this tension in this really interesting way. And so since we talk so much about utopia in the first bit, I'm mostly going to focus on the bad stuff, right? The science fiction empire and the Doctor is this kind of imperial figure, right? So obviously the utopian themes, right, we can kind of all recognize immediately, right? The Doctor offers his companions this immense personal freedom, freedom from work, freedom from constraint. They can go anywhere, they can do anything. Heroic self-sacrifice, meaningful life. But this freedom from the Doctor comes at this kind of significant cost. And again, the more recent version of the Doctor has kind of emphasized this, right? The emphasis on the time war, on the time lords, right? The Doctor constantly running into these aliens that have to be eliminated through genocidal violence, right? I think the silence is this kind of fascinating token of this in the most recent episodes, right? The pinnacle of human achievement, walking on the moon, is suddenly re-encoded as also this moment where whenever we see something, we have to kill it. And so the Doctor winds up embodying this kind of dark story that we can kind of locate in the companions. I was the one who asked the melancholy question. And the companions have this kind of melancholy story, right? Everyone is afraid, and his companions are kind of increasingly afraid. What would happen if the Doctor traveled by himself, right? If he didn't have this kind of middle-class British woman, usually, right, to constrain him and make sure he doesn't go wrong. Alongside that, we have this increasing sense in the later series that he's using these people up in some way, right? That he's turning them into weapons, kind of consuming their decency, uses them up, and then kind of discards them. And that's actually something we can kind of trace through the earlier seasons, but we have this kind of long trajectory. And so from this perspective, we wind up with the Doctor as this kind of very tragic and melancholic figure, as we see in the most recent series, right? This kind of lonely god. He can't connect to anybody because everybody in the universe is his instrument. And so he winds up kind of all alone and utterly bored. And so I'm interested in how this kind of political dimension of the Doctor might be thought, in particular with its kind of increasing popularity in America, right? In the earlier panel, we talked a little bit about Britain feeling like it's lost its relevance or lost its kind of empire, right? What does Britain do after empire? And so now America is kind of taking up this show in this same kind of moment of crisis, right? Well, who are we now, right, in the Bush administration after 9/11, right? In this kind of moment of kind of perpetual crisis, what is America's relevance? And so now the Doctor has come to America, right? And so we have this increasing cooperation between the two groups, thinking through this kind of basic question. So that's what I'm interested in when I watch Doctor Who.
I guess I'll introduce myself. That's a little bit strange. So I'm an associate professor of cultural studies and humanities at Columbia College Chicago. As the program notes, all my interest in philosophy and things regarding being in time probably stems from the Fourth Doctor. K-9 is my ideal pet, and I favor Doctor number 10. Okay, so I'm going to give you like a mini academic paper. Please don't persecute me afterwards. But I want to talk about being in time, and that's what I'll do. So, TARDIS person. So everybody knows the vehicle that the doctor uses to traverse time and space. And essentially, the TARDIS is a blue box which contains the problematic conjunction of being and time. So I'm going to start with the hardest place to start of all, Heidegger's On Time and Being. And this is what he says. How then is being supposed to be determined by time? Being is not a thing, thus nothing temporal, and yet it is determined by time as presence. Time is not a thing, thus nothing which is, and yet it remains constant in its passing away without being something temporal like beings in time. Being and time determine each other reciprocally, but in such a manner that neither the former, being, be addressed as something temporal, nor can the latter, time, be addressed as a being. So that's where we'll start. So traveling in the TARDIS engages us then with the very basics of philosophy. And I'll do my short form because it's, we have a lot of stuff to say today. In fact, given my own background as a scholar in both cultural studies and continental philosophy, I'd argue that Doctor Who capitalizes on is what Martin Heidegger called our pre-ontological understanding of being. So what does that mean? It means that our very being as human beings, what Heidegger called Dasein, or being there, is an orientation to the question of the meaning of being. And if you're new to Heidegger, let me translate all that. The difference between beings with a small b and being with a capital B is this. Beings are all the things that exist. Being with a capital B is the beingness of those things that exist, or those things insofar as they exist. And this metaphysics is concerned with the last thing, okay? So he says, we do not know what being means, but even if we ask what is being, we keep within an understanding of the is, though we are unable to fix conceptually what the is signifies. So, if the ultimate philosophical question is, what is the meaning of being, then our being is that being for which its own being is at issue. If to interpret the meaning of being becomes our task, Dasein, being there, human being, is not only the primary entity to be interrogated, it is also that entity which already comports itself in its being towards what we are asking about when we ask the question. That's from Being in Time. When we ask the question of the meaning of being, what we're doing is nothing other than the radicalization of an essential tendency of being, which belongs to Dasein itself. That tendency is the pre-ontological understanding of being, the orientation toward asking, what does this all mean, that structures human existence. That's the tendency upon which Doctor Who plays. In Heidegger's seminal text, Being in Time, he interrogates the meaning of being in two fundamental ways that structure not only contemporary philosophy, but also the travels of Doctor Who. First, in Division 1 of Being in Time, he undertakes the preparatory fundamental analysis of Dasein. What is that? He proceeds to phenomenologically interrogate this odd being, us, who asks about the meaning of its own being, that is to say, human being. While Heidegger's text proceeds with an existential analysis of Dasein to interrogate this strange being in its being, we see the same in the Doctor's universe. After all, what is the structuring question of newcomers on the Doctor's landscape? They always ask, Doctor Who, of course. Who are we as human beings? This is a question that continues to fascinate the Doctor himself. And the question of who these strange humans are motivates him. In fact, the mysterious nature of his newest companion, Clara, is the only thing that draws the Doctor back to being in the world after his grief over losing Amy and Rory. In the most recent episode, Journey to the Center of the TARDIS, he tells his perplexing companion, just tell me who you are. And she replies, you know who I am. He replies, no, I don't. I look at you every single day and I don't understand a thing about you. What are you, a trick, a trap? The 11th Doctor's Clara epitomizes what all human companions are for the Doctor, a perplexing, impossible mystery to be solved. Being there as human being is what brings him back to being in the world. But ultimately, Being in Time interrogates the meaning of being in a second fundamental way that structures not only contemporary philosophy, but also the very basis for the travels of the Doctor. In his second analysis, Heidegger explicates Dasein and temporality, the time part of the being and time equation. That is, Heidegger begins with human beings and points to temporality as the meaning of that being we call Dasein. As he argues, quote, time must be brought to light and genuinely conceived as the horizon for all understanding of being and for any way of interpreting it, end quote. Time is the horizon for any understanding of being, or as the second Doctor put it in The Evil of the Daleks, I am not a student of human nature. I am a professor of a far wider academy of which human nature is merely a part. And certainly, since the early to mid-20th century, with both the turn towards postmodern philosophy and the impact of Einstein's theory of relativity, it is as if time has taken center stage intellectually and imaginatively in our understanding of ourselves. In commenting on Hegel's theory of time, Heidegger recounts, hang on with me for a second, space is time. That is, time is the truth of space. If space is thought dialectically in that which it is, then according to Hegel, this being of space unveils itself as time. Half a century ago, when the philosophical and scientific worlds took that turn toward time, Doctor Who stepped onto the stage. The Doctor isn't just any traveler, of course. He's a time traveler, and indeed a time lord. The Doctor poses that imaginative option of mastering the very horizon upon which the meaning of existence is predicated. He understands time. In the End of Time Part 2, we learn about the Doctor's nemesis, the Master, in particular. We hear about the botched young Time Lord's initiation, where he stares into the untempered schism, a gap in reality that allows one to see into the time vortex itself. This vision, orchestrated by the leaders of Gallifrey, drives the Master insane. Time Lords get to see the whole of space and time, and this is the center of their magical appeal for us. The exquisite story, Blink, which features the 10th Doctor, brings this fascination to the center. And of course, everybody knows this quote from Blink, but as the Doctor says, people don't understand time. It's not what you think it is. It's complicated, very complicated. People assume that time is a strict progression from cause to effect. But actually, from a non-linear, non-subjective viewpoint, it's more like a big ball of wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey stuff. Heidegger couldn't have said it better. In fact, through the beautiful, circuitous route of Blink, we have the closest thing to a philosophy of time uttered by the Doctor, replete with time loops, time paradoxes, and questions of causality fundamentally disrupted. Blink does for Doctor Who what David Hume did for philosophy, in undermining the notion of linear cause. In the episode, the Doctor, trapped in 1969 without his TARDIS, must convince a woman in 2007, called Sally Sparrow, to send it back to him. Think about it. Who writes his lines on the DVD Easter egg? The Doctor simply reads them from the document he's been given by Sally Sparrow, and they're only on the document because Larry Nightingale copied them from the DVD. The paradox is that nobody actually created them. This scenario then introduces what many think of as the most horrifying villains in the Doctor Who universe, the Weeping Angels. The Weeping Angels that horrify us in Blink are the result of a threat to our very nature as creatures of space-time. We can handle Einstein's theory of the fabric of space and time being warped or distorted. That strikes us as cool, not scary. But when the Weeping Angels rip Sally's friend Kathy out of her location in space and time, they tear her away from everything she cares about. In removing her from her place and time, the angels remove Kathy from herself, depositing her in a new life in which the details of her previous life will become incoherent, disjointed, and conceptually unintelligible. The Weeping Angels do significant harm to their victims insofar as the victims are time and place-bound persons. One might call this a form of death, as the Doctor does, explaining that the Weeping Angels, quote, are the only psychopaths in the universe to kill you nicely. That's the heart of the horror. The angels are fantastically frightening creations because they attack in an oddly non-gruesome way. But they attack at the heart of that intersection which allows us to take a place in the world, the parameters of which structure the meaning of being. And perhaps that's the philosophical and imaginative appeal of the Doctor. He seems to have a privileged relationship to space and time, one where, apart from the complications of some temporal paradoxes and some fixed points in time, he stands outside it all. In not being bound to time as Dasein is, the Doctor exemplifies our greatest imaginary freedom, the freedom from temporality and, of course, from finitude. Heidegger famously called Dasein's existence Sein zum Tod, being toward death. From this fact of our existence, we are always on the way to death, always in a temporal sequence, not of our own making, what the existentialists called facticity. Jim Jarmusch, in the opening of his spectacular film Dead Man, uses a wonderful quote from Oscar Michaud as an epigraph. It is preferable not to travel with a dead man. In a sense, the tragedy of Doctor Who is that this is exactly what the Doctor is doing. Every time he takes on a companion, he is in fact traveling with a dead man or woman. Human being is being toward death. This is the heart of the Doctor's grief and the pathos of the series. His loss of Rose, the necessary forgetting of Donna, the sealing off in time of Amy and Rory, at the angel's hands, of course. This is the epic sense of loss and grief driving the 11th Doctor's new season. This, too, is part of why we love the Doctor. As Sally Sparrow explains, what's good about sad? Sad is happy for deep people. The Doctor, on the other hand, seems to escape the fate of his human companions. He is, of course, 11 Doctors and counting, also on the way to death. Time Lords aren't necessarily immortal, but with the potential of regeneration and the ability to see the horizon of space-time itself, the Doctor does what we can't do, step out of our place in being and time. That's why the character in Blink who receives the Doctor's message from out of time is called Sally Sparrow. One hears that name and one hears only Hamlet. There is special providence in this fall of a sparrow. If it be now, 'tis not to come. If it be not to come, it will be now. If it be not now, yet it will come. The readiness is all. That's why the doctor is so compelling to his companions and to us. The readiness is all. He responds to that readiness in his very being with an enthusiastic Geronimo. Okay. All right. And now I'll bring you to happier topics than death. Being toward death. Have a nice day. Okay. I'm very pleased to introduce Ashley Hink, a PhD candidate in rhetoric, politics, and culture at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her work has appeared in Argumentation and Advocacy and Transformative Works and Cultures.
So I'm so excited to be a part of this panel because we've already heard two great speakers talk about the rich philosophy that's in Doctor Who. Part of what I'd like to add to this discussion is an example and explanation of how that philosophy gets moved from a fictional TV show to the real world. To do this, I want to talk about two key terms that can help us think through this question. And in part two, I want to offer an example of how that happened in the Fan Activism Project. So, part one. When we think about how philosophy gets moved from a fictional TV show like Doctor Who to the real world, we're focusing our attention on the kind of philosophies that direct our actions or tell us how to live. These we might call ethics, or what I like to call ethical frameworks. Doctor Who ethical frameworks can be thought of as the lessons or moral themes of Doctor Who. So to articulate a Doctor Who ethical framework, we might ask questions like, what does it mean for the doctor to protect the earth? What is the role of the companion? What makes the doctor's enemies evil? What makes the doctor good? What trade-offs does the doctor accept? What does the doctor seek to protect? And many other questions. So clearly there are lots of different answers to these questions and lots of different questions we could ask to arrive at a variety of ethical frameworks. But rhetoric is what invites fans to see a particular ethical framework and apply that ethical framework to a current issue in a particular way. Rhetoric can be thought of as discourse or public talk. It's all of the political speeches, pamphlets, commercials, billboards, and other public communication that fills our lives. In other words, rhetoric is communication about public issues, and rhetoric is what helps us coordinate action about those public issues. This is where we persuade citizens to vote a particular way, donate money to a particular charity, or volunteer their time in a particular way. In relationship to ethical frameworks, rhetoric is what persuades us to use the same ethical framework applied in the same way, to take whatever activist action is requested, whether that's voting in an election, donating money, or volunteering. Rhetoric is what takes the doctor's philosophy, the Doctor Who ethical framework, and brings it into the real world for a whole group of people. So ethical framework and rhetoric help us understand how philosophies of Doctor Who can merge into the real world. Now, let's turn our attention to an example of when that happened. Last fall, I worked with a group of high school students at a local high school in Madison to develop a fan activism project. They chose the text, Doctor Who, of course, identified an ethical framework, and applied it to global warming. Then they created their own rhetoric, blog entries, that invited other Doctor Who fans to take action too. They titled the blog Companions Against Global Warming. And if you're interested, you can see the blog at cvsgw.wordpress.com, Companions versus Global Warming. So they made a number of arguments. They said, the Union of Concerned Scientists can be our Torchwood Five. Global warming is such a large threat to Earth that it's the equivalent of all of the doctor's enemies combining forces. Global warming scientists are like allies of the doctor, and the doctor isn't going to save us. We have to be our own companions. Here, students invited other Doctor Who fans to apply a Doctor Who ethical framework to global warming activism. Through rhetoric, Doctor Who's philosophy became relevant to global warming. So in conclusion, I'd like to point out just a couple of implications. First, this project demonstrates the richness of the intersection between rhetoric and media studies. And secondly, that Doctor Who's philosophy is rich and significant. Doctor Who offers great potential for social change.
Thank you. I'm very pleased now to introduce Derek Campari, who is an associate professor of film and media arts at Southern Methodist University. He studies media history and theory and teaches about TV, film, comics, and video games. He's the author of Rerun Nation and CSI. He first encountered Doctor Who seven doctors ago in 1981.
It's Compare, actually. Too.
Compare, thank you. Sorry about that.
My background in my my field is media studies, and so my interest in philosophy has come from a little bit different direction with this. I'm interested in historical context, cultural context, these sorts of things. And what I wanted to focus on with this, and you can see the longer version of this on my blog, is on this idea of a DNA of media property, of a franchise. Everything's got a DNA, and that DNA keeps going through that, no matter what iteration, no matter what form it takes. So Star Trek, for example, no matter what Star Trek is going to be, fundamentally, it's still this thing that's very much of the 60s, very much of this particular moment of the 60s, not only culturally and politically, but in terms of the television industry at the time, which is mid-60s action-adventure TV, is always going to be hard-baked into that. So for Doctor Who, I think it has an originary DNA, but it also has subsequent generations of DNA that get baked into that. So the further we go along with Doctor Who, there's layers of this that basically happen and continue to inform what the show is at this point. So let me describe these layers and the impact they've had. The first layer, and the most fundamental, obviously, is the origin of the show. And for that, I think you need to really think about the BBC and its role as a national institution in Britain of the early 1960s. And so Doctor Who comes in shortly after Television Center is opened. It's very much meant to be a Saturday family tea time sort of fare. And even though there's plenty of stylistic changes that go on the first 17 seasons of the show, it's very much this national public service model institution of British culture at that time. And this gets reflected in the show itself. And so the Doctor is an emphatically English character, not quite British. I'm going to argue he's more an English character in this period in the 60s and 70s. He's an agent of disorder. He may not do things the right way, but he always gets the right result from that. It's a model of national institution where England survives somehow, that it's ultimately optimistic despite being dripped in blood, as Russell Davies has it. England survives somehow into the future. We get variations on this hero, of course, so John Pertwee is sort of channeling James Bond most famously with this, and Tom Baker is channeling Oscar Wilde and other sorts of figures, and these are essentially English kinds of characters there. But mostly this is a period when the BBC has full faith in Doctor Who, when it's functioning as a strong national institution across the board. It's taken for granted this. This is something that is very much a proud British kind of thing. Around the time John Nathan Turner takes over the production of the show, this starts to change. And it's not his fault. It's not his fault at all with this. This is a political and cultural shift going on in Britain at the time, and particularly, specifically, the attitudes within the BBC towards the program begin to sour considerably there. Ed Stradling at Gallifrey mentioned that the ratings basically, if you look at the through line of the ratings the last 10 years of the show, it basically dwindled off on there with a few spikes in there. And this is a reflection of its ceasing to be so much a national institution and becoming more of a cult institution at this time. And so while it was fading as a national institution, it was being embraced as a cult institution. And I would argue that the production of the show really took this on, so that the Doctors during the 80s are brandishing this sort of difference, this otherness from the situations that they get in much more than they did in the previous Doctors, particularly in terms of Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy's Doctor being sort of inscrutable and mysterious and everything. The series, particularly the last few years, really kind of goes out down what I would call cult alley in this way. It says, nobody else is watching it but the cult audience. We're going to program for them and do some interesting sorts of things. And by that point, it really was an afterthought for the national audience. It was really just basically on running on fumes as far as the national audience is concerned, but some great, amazing stories nonetheless. And that's the point in which the fans take over. That's the point in which, essentially, the show goes off the air. The BBC doesn't care about it anymore. They give the license to Virgin Books, and the fans embrace it. And from that point in the 90s, which is my years, I was most active in Doctor Who fandom, the so-called wilderness years, it becomes thoroughly a fan kind of institution. The DNA there is, we've embraced this thing, we're going to take that on, we're going to make it more experimental, we're going to make it darker, we're going to make it more adult, we're going to move on with that. And this is where the novels come in, both the Virgin and BBC novels, and at the end of this period, the Big Finish audios, taking this in directions it couldn't be. And so there's a very big difference between it being a cult institution and something that's embraced and loved by maybe a few hundred thousand people in all at this point, versus something that's a national institution that's broadcast to millions and is assumed to be part of the national culture. Now, when the show comes back, when they announce it's coming back in 2003, and then it starts coming on the air in 2005, the BBC has re-embraced it as a national institution again, pretending that the 90s never happened, essentially, on there. Although, obviously, people that are writing for the show, and Russell Davies and Stephen Moffat themselves, they loved the novels in the 90s. Russell Davies even wrote one of them. And so that's very much part of the fabric of the show. Again, that DNA is still there. It's not publicly acknowledged by the BBC, but it's still very much there. And so what is a national institution now versus in the 60s and 70s? Well, a national institution is entrepreneurial. It's as a global media product. It's, hey, look at me. It's all hand-wavy. And the doctor is reflecting that, in that he's much more brazen. He's much more sort of narcissistic. He's much more show-offy. The show itself is designed to be a thrill ride for a global television audience. It was never designed for a global television audience on its original run. It's very much designed for that now, from the get-go. That's why you see so many tourist landmarks of London pop out throughout the series constantly. And so Davies and Moffat relate to this too, because they have to be incessant hype machines for this to make it consistent for the global market. They have to kind of keep that going. This is why the doctors are younger. This is why they're extroverted. This is why they're clever boys consistently with this, to keep that institution there. So again, that's the DNA that we have with this now. All the other DNA is still there. All these things sort of continue to inform it, and the flavors of that continue to come on. But once this DNA is there now, the entrepreneurial global television product that is Doctor Who right now, that's going to continue to be the case in the future in whatever iteration it takes on. So this is part of that entire package with that. And like with Star Trek, like with Star Wars, like with any other long-running media franchise and things, that's an unavoidable part of that. That whatever that thing that's baked in through the layers of there is always going to be there. It's never too far from the surface with that. And so with Doctor Who having so many of these iterations over so many years, it's just interesting to see where that's going to take us next. But again, all that stuff is always still there.
Thank you. I'm pleased to now introduce Scott Paith, an associate professor of religious studies at DePaul University. He studies public theology, applied ethics, philosophy of religion, and religion and culture. He is not a 903-year-old Time Lord, though often he wishes he were.
I'm just in Time Lord drag today. But it's very helpful, I think, for me to have followed you, because you very much laid out the whole question of what the moral frameworks are that are addressed in Doctor Who. And I think that the best way for me to approach the topic is to approach it from my primary discipline, which is as an ethicist. And what I'm particularly interested in is the question of just what are the ethics of the Doctor? How does he go about making moral decisions, and how should we as viewers understand the moral decision-making process that he undertakes? And generally speaking, when ethicists talk about sort of the frameworks in which ethical decision-making is done, we usually contemplate them as either sort of deontological, principle-oriented ethical theories, or we talk about them in terms of sort of teleological or consequentialist approaches to ethics, or we talk about them often in terms of contextual or virtue approaches to ethics. And the Doctor does not fit neatly into any of those categories. I mean, he's by no means a principled-based ethical thinker. He does not begin from a set of fundamental moral rules and then reason out from them toward his actions. I would suggest that the best way of understanding the Doctor's ethics is that he's a fundamentally intuitive, pragmatic, and contextual ethical thinker. When you look at the way that the Doctor makes decisions from a moral point of view, it is very much rooted in the particular circumstances in which he finds himself, very much rooted in sort of the demands of the setting, and very much rooted in sort of his own sort of intuitive take on what the right thing to do is. He doesn't have a hard and fast sense that there is a single right course of action that must be pursued under any circumstances. It's always very context dependent. That said, he does have, I think, an underlying conception of human dignity. I think his ethics are thoroughly, well, humanist, Time Lordist, sentientist, I mean, however you want to frame that. But that very much, when he's dealing with sentient beings, he's dealing with them as beings that have an innate dignity that needs to be respected. And this sense of human, this sense of dignity pertains not only to his companions or to the people he's trying to help, but even to his enemies. And I think this is reflected in the fact that, you know, his sort of his one warning rule, right? That if he has any rule at all, it's the one warning rule, that everybody gets one warning, and if you decide to go ahead with your diabolical course of action after you've been warned, then he allows you not only to suffer the consequences, but in fact will go out of his way, at least in terms of the 10th Doctor, to magnify your suffering. And this is nowhere clearer than the way that he treats the family of blood in that episode, where he says, well, so your goal was eternal life. Well, now you have it, and then, of course, each get their own particularly excruciatingly horrible form of eternal life. And so I think that sense of the underlying dignity of sentient beings tempers his very pragmatic and consequentialist approach to morality. And I would use as sort of a contrast case Captain Jack Harkness. Because it's very interesting to look at Captain Jack as a pragmatic moral thinker and contrast him with the Doctor. Because there are things that, even though the Doctor has committed at least two acts of genocide of which we are aware, one against potentially three, and you could even make the case for four. But certainly he committed genocide against the Daleks, and he committed genocide against the Time Lord. But we never see that on screen, so we only see his reaction to it. On the other hand, and so for all we know, he is capable of being as ruthless at times as Captain Jack. But in another sense, when we see Captain Jack, what we really see is Captain Jack acting pragmatically, acting ruthlessly, and being willing to sacrifice utterly anything and everything for the sake of whatever his conception of the greater good is. And it's always, for Captain Jack, a very personal conception of the greater good. He doesn't consult anybody else. He doesn't make his decisions as a result of sort of any obviously larger moral framework. You know, it's just when Captain Jack decides what the greater good is, Captain Jack does what's necessary to pursue that, up to and including causing the deaths of people who are close to him. And there's a sense in which Captain Jack is, because of that, a very tragic figure. He's a figure who is sort of crushed by the burden of his own moral responsibility. Whereas I think because the Doctor is willing to grant all beings a dignity and allow them an escape hatch, even if they don't pursue it, he is in a very real sense a more morally optimistic figure. There's a sense in which even though he can be ruthless, he's driven by deeper motivations rooted not simply in pure consequentialism, but really rooted in a conception that all sentient beings deserve a fundamental dignity, and that he has an obligation to provide that to them. Whether or not they choose to exercise that dignity in a way that allows him to spare them is ultimately on them, as he would perceive it. And so he bears the responsibility for his actions, just as Captain Jack does. But I think he bears that responsibility more lightly because ultimately is a responsibility that he shares with the people who he interacts with, both in terms of his companions and in terms of his foes.
Thank you. I'm also pleased to introduce Philip Sandifer, the writer of TARDIS Eruditorum. An ongoing critical history of Doctor Who, as well as books on Wonder Woman and They Might Be Giants. And you have the URLs in your program.
Thank you. One of the, I think, perils of looking at a show like Doctor Who that's, you know, British from the U.S. is we have an at times unseemly tendency to make the show about us in a way that it's not and never has been. And so, you know, one of the things I tried to look at on the blog, and what I want to talk about very briefly here, is framing it in terms of a British cultural tradition, and not even just an outward-looking one about, you know, Britain's relationship with empire, is Britain going to survive, all of that. But I think Doctor Who really fits into a very, very old, you know, much older than, you know, the idea of the British Empire tradition of portals to fairy, portals into other worlds, which you can find in, you know, British folklore, Arthurian mythos. And for me, Doctor Who fits into this tradition of, you know, people like William Blake, this very radical tradition in Britain. I was a little puzzled last panel when we had this moment of talking about how, you know, the doctor seems unusual in his radical, you know, individual rebelliousness in British culture. Because to me, the British culture he comes out of is, you know, the same one that, tongue not entirely in cheek, celebrates the guy that tried to blow up Parliament once a year. You know, that has, you know, William Blake, mad visionary poet who sees, you know, angels and visions of gods and creates his own utterly bizarre heretical mythology. And, you know, for me, it's this very specifically and peculiarly British view of within the normal world, within our everyday experience, there are these eccentric, strange spaces that open up with these vast, you know, bigger on the inside interiorities that we can stumble into, fall out of the world and come upon this radical otherness within everyday space. It's in some ways very much not, for me, a show about, you know, the vast frontiers of exploration and imperialism. It's about, well, the sort of culture that comes up when you're on a kind of small wet island where, you know, you kind of have to make your own magic to some extent. It's a show that's very consumed with the idea of the tension between confined spaces and vast spaces. Hence, you know, even in some ways a central joke that, you know, throughout the classic series, the show can go anywhere, but as long as it's, you know, a rock quarry, a bunch of corridors, and you can lock them in a cell for most of the episode. You know, anywhere in the universe, as long as it's very, very small. And so, you know, I didn't prep anything at great length here, but I just wanted to throw out this sort of alternative to the sort of Americanization, globalness of Doctor Who, especially because, I mean, I'll certainly grant that the Moffat era and the present day is written with the full knowledge that, you know, the show is going to be airing same day in a ton of different countries. But even in terms of the new series, you know, that's what I'm writing about on the blog right now. I'm actually was torturing Rob Shearman at dinner last night with the knowledge that right now I'm in the middle of the entry on Dalek. but that first Eccleston series is so much about establishing the show in British culture. What's so interesting about it is that it has no interest in the American audience yet, because it recognizes tacitly that there's no way that you're going to get an American audience unless you win BBC One over first. And I do, you know, just as sort of a note of caution when talking about, you know, Doctor Who and philosophy is, let us all not forget that this is first and foremost a British show. I mean, I think that Derek had a really good point about it coming out of the BBC as national institution. But even there, part of the whole gist of the BBC is that it has this mandate to serve everybody. Mm-hmm. It's a national institution, but in a way that's very hard for Americans to understand, because it has this weird public service commitment to serving every part of the country in a sort of, we don't care who you are, if, you know, even if none of us like you, if you're British, we have to serve you. Which even, you know, the Welsh dimension of the program, which, for God's sake, people need to talk more about the relationship between, you know, Wales and the rest of Britain, and thus BBC Wales, because that's a fascinating vein. But it's a culture where things, Top of the Pops is a great example, if I can go on a little past my time slot. I'm not the only one who's done so I'm going to. Top of the Pops was this weekly charts roundup show where they'd have, you know, various bands that were in high in the pop charts lip sync dutifully along with their songs in the studio. And in order to do that, the BBC, which, you know, legally and ethically couldn't step into the shifting sands of getting involved in, you know, the corporate pop market, had to take a very nonpartisan view, such that if you were rising in the charts, you could be on Top of the Pops, period. They didn't care what you were. They couldn't care what you were. So, you know, the Sex Pistols appeared on Top of the Pops. The Smiths appeared prominently on Top of the Pops with Morrissey, you know, flouncing about on stage, twirling flowers around. Which, in, you know, the early 1980s, in early Thatcher era, you have Morrissey as the gayest thing on the planet on BBC One. And, you know, this is transformative, the idea of the eccentric in the mainstream space. The Pertwee era, for all it, you know, for all we talk about it as the very buttoned-down James Bond period, it's the David Bowie period of Doctor Who. It's the one that's going on alongside, you know, Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, where, you know, David Bowie, because he was rising in the charts and thus the BBC had no choice, does this wonderfully bizarre performance of Starman on Top of the Pops that, you know, as every dad in Doctor Who muttered when, you know, a glam rock came on, act came on Top of the Pops, it looks like something out of Doctor Who. And, you know, this relationship between the mainstream and the eccentric in British culture and the fact that BBC One, the national broadcaster, has this commitment to weirdness that Doctor Who fits very hugely into is, I think, a very peculiarly British thing, that relationship between the margins and the mainstream that they have that's very different from American weirdness. And is very much for me, you know, the cultural tradition, the DNA, and the philosophy of Doctor Who is the weird stuff is part and parcel of day-to-day life. Day-to-day life is terribly, terribly bizarre, and their shop window dummies could kill you at any moment.
That's very good. What a wonderful range of commentaries, and I'm really happy that we do have time for discussion, so I'd love to open it up to whatever comments, questions, whatever people want to add.
Okay, so as a token British person in this long game, I'll just say that actually that's a remarkably good summary of the institutionalized weirdness of Britain. And I'd say one of the big differences about between British and American culture is that in Britain it's kind of accepted that people are a bit eccentric and weird. And as long as you can act your little bit of, you're a cog in the machine. So, you know, you're expected, when you go to a bus stop, you will queue with everybody else at the bus stop. As long as you can manage that, it doesn't matter what the hell else you do. Wear ruffled shirts or a big hat and a scarf, that's fine. So that is a really important part of British culture that I think is represented in Doctor Who. I'd say that the thing that you didn't mention, but perfectly reasonably, because we'd be then here for 2 hours discussing it.
Right, I mean, the blog is a million words long or so.
Especially the 70s version of Doctor Who is incredibly based on Christ. Especially if you get Malcolm Hulks writing it. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, I'm going to give you my little Marxist diatribe.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Brilliant. Mm-hmm. And that, I'd say, is the one other thing that I would throw into the mix that otherwise you did. That was a really good summary.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
Chris, can you just follow up on that with the sort of eccentricity piece? Well, in America, what do we do with that? What do we do with weirdness?
Marginalize it?
Beat it up on the screen.
No, no. Commodify it.
Yep.
It's a franchise.
Yep. Both.
Yeah, I just have a question for Derek. I find your analysis very interesting, especially the bit where you talk about the 1980s being about sort of a cult audience. Do you think the BBC tried to make a bid for the national audience again with a series such as Blake 7?
That's a great point. And in the other broader context of things going on, and actually at that time, kind of, yeah. I mean, with Blake 7, at least initially with this. I mean, Terry Nation was certainly a hot commodity. There was a seriousness to this. There was an idea of a, you know, a dramatic sort of series. We're going to take this idea of science fiction, make it for the adults, keep that going. But that tapered off pretty quickly with that, in terms of how that of the impact of that. And so there was at least in the late 70s when Blake 7 started, there was a little bit of an uncertainty with that. So yeah, and there's other things going on at that particular moment that come in, and even later, even something like as bizarre as Star Cops, which was in the mid 80s, still kind of has at least serious ambitions and such in a way. But by that point, I think comfortably cult in a way that Blake 7 was much more mainstream, at least in its aims, even just several years earlier.
I want to know about the Doctor's morality. When it came to Justice of the Daleks, where he decided not to put those two wires together to the creation of the Daleks, where did his way of thinking change when it came to Waters of Mars, where he thought, oh, I'm too, you know, he's so full of himself, that he decided to change events and save those survivors. And then the base commander kills herself because he was like, I'm the Time Lord victorious. Where did the Doctor's way of thinking change between then and that and now?
You know, what's striking to me is that, you know, there was a point at which the Doctor did have the option to commit genocide against the Daleks and opted not to. Mm-hmm. And then by the time we get to the new series, of course, You know, we know that at some point prior to the resurgence of the series, he has done precisely that. And then, as you point out, by the time you get to Waters of Mars, you've got the sort of the Doctor embracing a sort of a Nietzschean conception of himself, right? This idea that he is, as you said, the Time Lord victorious, and he's going to sort of project his will to power out into the world and refashion reality in his own image. And of course, what he realizes very quickly is that a fixed point is a fixed point, and he actually isn't as capable of doing what he imagines himself to do as he thinks. And this, of course, then begins sort of the decline of the 10th Doctor at the end of the Russell T. Davies era. But it seems to me that what humanizes the Doctor, and I think the series makes this point over and over again, what humanizes the Doctor is his companions. Right? It's the fact that he travels with others, and those others call him on his arrogance and sort of give him a reference point outside of himself that allows him to maintain a moral center. It's when he lacks that sort of external view of his actions that he seems to tilt over into the more megalomaniacal dimension of his character. And so I think that what happens is by the time you see Chris Eccleston appear in the first episode of the new series, I think one can infer that he had been without a companion for some time, and that probably suggests why he begins as such a cold, aloof, and harsh figure at the beginning of that series, and then by the time Eccleston regenerates into Tennant, you have the beginning of a more morally sensitive and more morally nuanced conception of the Doctor, because now he's got someone to reflect his own actions back at him.
I think that's great, but what's happened in the Moffat years in particular, right, is that connection seems to be breaking down in some way, right, where he seems to be more and more this kind of figure that can't get back to that level of connection, right, and so I was really interested with Clara in the recent episode points out, right, you view everybody as a baby and a ghost, mm-hmm. right, like you don't have a human connection, right, and he actually, I mean, in a weird way, this is his solution to the problem, like he realizes that the monster needs a companion, right? Mm-hmm. That he's discovering more and more that the very thing that makes him this kind of utopian, attractive figure also makes him this kind of inhuman monster who doesn't have a human connection, right? And I find that paradox really interesting. And, you know, Moffat's obviously obsessed with it, right? When
right.
somebody else takes over, maybe we'll relax about that a little bit. But there's this kind of continuing sense, right, that the Doctor himself is a danger, right? Asylum of the Daleks is another great episode, right, where he realizes that in some sense he actually is creating the Daleks, right? Mm. Like the Batman and the Joker scenario, right?
Right?
Where he's training them to be more and more evil, mm. right? And the weird utopian solution that Clara comes up with is, right, we could just forget each other, right? Mm. We could just each go our own way and, like, move on.
Yeah.
I want to just resist a little bit the idea, though, that this shift is entirely a product of the new series, because, I mean, the first time the Doctor changes his mind on that Genesis of the Daleks choice and actually, you know, decides, no, I totally have the right, is, of course, Remembrance of the Daleks
yep.
in the late 80s, where he nukes Skaro,
yeah.
You know, just tricks Davros into annihilating the planet, and the strong implication is wipes out the Daleks entirely. I mean,
with a lot of relish, actually,
right,
too.
I mean, he's
yeah.
having a blast
yeah.
doing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing about, and this...
25 years ago.
and this gets back to what you were saying again about the radical political tradition of it, you know, the Marxist tradition, because, of course, the other thing the McCoy era was the point where Doctor Who really became viciously anti-Thatcher, and it's
yeah.
delicious repeatedly as a
yeah.
result, because, you know, everything good in 1980s Britain was anti-Thatcher. but... what's interesting is, you know, by that point, Thatcher had won re-election, and, you know, by 88 had won it twice, I believe. And so what you have that's interesting there is a Doctor who sort of weirdly cedes a lot of ground to Thatcher, and that he is, you know, by that point, you have Thatcher as this almost mythic figure who can somehow, you know, weasel her way out of any electoral defeat, no matter how much you throw at her, no matter how awful... she is, you know, the comics writer Warren Ellis memorably describes living in Thatcher's Britain as worrying every morning that you're going to wake up and she'll finally have installed a Dalek on the corner. you know, the, and you know, no matter how bad it gets, she keeps winning re-election by a landslide. And so what you have in McCoy's doctor is this doctor who's just as good at playing this sort of long, cynical, manipulative political game as Thatcher, but who is still fundamentally a force of strangeness and weirdness in the world as well. And in some ways, I find that sort of weird transition point a little bit more of an interesting place to look at that have I the right ethics than the new series, which exists in this, you know, post-Thatcher neoliberal consensus, as opposed to this weird moment where it's giving, where, you know, you're at the point of transition. And it's notable how much of the new series, owes itself to the McCoy era or the, you know, Virgin Books era of the Wilderness years. I mean, I want to disagree with you a little bit on the degree to which the Wilderness years are marginal. It's not just that, you know, Russell T. Davies wrote one of the books. It's that, you know, the first series consists entirely of writers who wrote for the Virgin era, plus true. Rob Shearman. You know, they adapted Human Nature. Planet of the Dead was originally an adaptation of Gareth Roberts' The Highest Science. The Chelonians, a random monster, get name-checked in Pandora Opens. I mean, the debt the show quietly owes to the Wilderness years and that, you know, 80s, 90s, anti-Thatcher culture is very, very profound. And I think if you really want to look at, you know, where that transition happens, it's not the new series. It's about 1987, 1988 classic series. It really is where that have I the right question changes. In a way, I think out of a sort of bullied desperation, you know, have I the right? If I don't have the right, there's no other way to stop Thatcher. There's sort of this, you know, the right has become, the political right has become so monstrous at that point that the niceties of, you know, the charming man in the scarf who decides he doesn't have the right to wipe out the Nazis, you can't afford to be like that anymore. Now you have to be much harder and harsher and more willing to annihilate Scarra.
Thinking about being in time and how the show is always in regeneration, is it perhaps showing that if there is any kind of essence to being, it is time, and that time is therefore change? And how does that intersect with the show always playing towards the absurd? And, you know, is it even bringing up the question that the question of being and change is fundamentally absurd? And what do you think of that?
I think that makes perfect sense. How's that for a short answer? I think it makes perfect sense, and actually I'd like to take your question and piggyback on your Philip's comments, is that I think that your description just now is a really good explanation for why the show becomes cult in America in that moment, because there's this space of counter-hegemonic kind of pressure coming from a kind of pop culture source that Americans were not accustomed to. And it was like a very strong political pull, I think, on many of us, right? But yes, your question is beautiful, and yes.
I'm really interested in it. Thinking about, I don't know if anyone's ever read Umberto Eco's essay on Superman, he talks about how Superman has to kind of constantly revert to this original position, right? So there's a counter move, right, where Doctor Who can never change, right? He kind of always has to reset to this kind of basic story premise with the man, the box, and the companion, right? I mean, in that sense, it reminds me of the Peter Pan stuff that Moffat was ripping off for the Amy years, right, where Peter Pan comes back years later. He doesn't even remember Captain Hook. Tinkerbell is so long gone, Peter Pan can't remember anything. He doesn't know who Wendy is, and he runs off with her daughter, right? That there's this kind of constant renewal that's also a return, right? Because the show can't end. It isn't a novel. It isn't a two-hour movie. It's designed to last forever, and so it's designed in some sense so that nothing can ever happen, right? The consumer element of the show, in some sense, is its being, or its ontological being. It always has to come back to a story that one could start now, right? No one is expected to go back to 63 to watch An Unearthly Child. It has to have multiple jump-in points, which creates, in some sense, I mean, the brilliance of its storytelling engine is its flexibility, right? That it constantly renews itself such that it wipes out its own past.
I think we have time for one more.
Is Doctor Who really basically like a type of situation ethics? He does enough just to keep going to the next regeneration, rather than he has a coherent philosophy?
Yeah.
Star Trek or Star Wars or Babylon 5.
You know, it would be really interesting had we the time and perhaps I'll have to write something about this, to kind of do a comparative analysis of sort of the ethical systems of, say, a Doctor Who versus a Star Trek versus a Star Wars, because there's a sense in which all of those series play with some kind of sort of contextual ethic, or play with the limitations of ethical systems, right? I mean, so you've always got the Prime Directive in Star Trek, and the question of, well, what are the limits of the Prime Directive? When can it be overturned? You know, if you're Picard, never. If you're Kirk, always. And I think what the Doctor, I think use the term situation ethics, which is a term that I think sometimes gets a bad rap. But it's a useful term in its sort of original incarnation. So if you read Joseph Fletcher's Situation Ethics, how he conceives of it is as a form of Christian ethic in which there are no moral principles, but there is a fundamental sort of rooted in an instinct toward love, right? So that everything we do must be motivated by and rooted in a conception of love for the other, right? Disinterested Christian love for the other. And so there's a sense in which I think the Doctor's ethic is in that way a situation ethic. And so what I was referring to earlier as human dignity could be retranslated as sort of a, kind of a deep agapic love. And that as a result, he cannot say in advance what is going to motivate what is going to motivate a particular action on his part, but clearly that action is always going to be based on a conception that sentient beings are beings worthy of love, dignity, and respect. And you know, I was thinking something I didn't mention in my talk is one place where I think this is clearest is in the episode "The Beast Below," because at that point he is then faced with sort of a kind of a classic moral dilemma, right? I can either destroy Britain, right? I can kill the beast, or I can sort of make it brain dead, right? And with those options, he says, I will no longer be the Doctor, right? If those are my only options, I will no longer be the Doctor. And so clearly his identity is so wrapped up in the idea that he cannot allow this being to continue on in agony. But it would be morally wrong for him to kill it, isn't because it would be a violation of some sort of Kantian categorical imperative, but precisely because all of the options that are available to him would violate the love and dignity that he is responsible for having toward everybody in the scenario, both the people in the kind of Britain that's rebuilt on the back of the Star Whale and the Star Whale. Right, that they are both worthy of respect and dignity, but he cannot give it to both of them, given the parameters that he's allowed himself. And so the fact that the dilemma is ultimately to let the whale go free, and then the whale itself freely chooses to continue to carry the people on its back, is sort of a wonderful affirmation of that underlying sense of freedom, dignity, and goodness of all of the agents involved. Perhaps from my perspective, unjustifiably optimistic, but still nevertheless rooted in that conception that love and dignity is at the heart of it, and that no moral principle can tell you how to act any better than that instinct.
The other moment that I thought you were going to say for sure was my favorite moment in the series is the death of the Doctor, right? Where mm-hmm. we have the Doctor who has saved everybody, and we have an old man we barely know. We don't care about. We know we're never going to see again anyway, right? I mean, the audience doesn't want the Doctor to make this switch, but he must, right? Because otherwise he wouldn't be the Doctor. And I mean, that's this moment of pure love where he himself, you know, and David Tennant is literally, you know, really crying, right, to leave. But the Doctor has to give in to love.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's particularly striking about that is he doesn't do it happily.
Yeah.
He's very angry at Wilf for putting him in this situation.
Right. That's what's so great about it. I love that moment. Yeah.
But I don't know if the audience is rooting against Wilf. I mean, he's been Bernard Cribbins. He's been idealizing British culture for as long as Doctor Who.
We're not happy to see him die, but I would have taken another 5 years to David Tennant.
I don't know that British culture would over Bernard Cribbins, though.
Sadly, time has run out. Thank you for all your wonderful comments and questions and for the very interesting commentary of the panelists.